The Guardian. Football Weekly.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, transfer madness fallout. Football players overpriced, suggest reports. Unlike Alex Reid, will never be overpriced. Pod joins in general astonishment. How can Carroll be worth £15 million less than Torres when he scored way more goals this season? We count down to Sunday's big reunion at Stamford Bridge and round up the midweek action. West Ham off the bottom, Man City held by the Brummies, and that Rooney brace for United. Altogether now, he's like a new signing. There's news from Italy and Spain, your posts and tweets, and a special salute to Gary Neville. He's kissed his badge in front of the cop. He's kissed Paul Scholes on the gob. Now he kisses his career goodbye before Harry could offer a £500,000 for him too. All of that in today's Football Weekly Extra. Yes, off we go then with on board Paul Doyle.
Hello.
Hi, Paul. Barry Glendening.
Hi, James.
Hi, Barry. And Tom Lutz.
Hello.
Hi, Tom. Very old school lineup, I think I'm right in thinking. Here we are then, 3 days after Monday. Not much has happened since we signed off, Barry, on Monday.
No.
No.
Steve Bruce went to the cinema.
Steve Bruce did go to the cinema, and there was all those midweek games, and Gary Neville announced his retirement. Not yet. Yes. And, of course, all that transfer business. It really kicked off on Monday. Now, everybody has said they're tuppence halfpenny worth, or similarly appropriate figure, on the various moves. So a few reactions on the posts. HK1234 says, Pazzini cost £8.6 million. Hernandez cost £7 million in the summer. Liverpool are idiots. This is pretty much relating to the £35 million for Andy Carroll. Chasm, £35 million for a talented but inexperienced striker who is nursing an injury that he sustained when too drunk to sit upright on a stool in a casino and who is only on bail on condition his club captain acts as a chaperone. Wow. Benny O'Donnell says, does Carroll still have to live with Kevin Nolan under the terms of his bail? Maybe they haven't thought this one through. Benelik asks whether the whole thing will enter the argot, as in jump the shark, nuke the fridge, bought the Carroll. But is it really so crazy? They have effectively swapped Torres and Ryan Babel for the exciting young Andy Carroll, who scored more goals than Torres this year, and the very exciting Luis Suarez, and with a net spend of £1.8 million, Paul Doyle.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And also, if you consider the type of striker that Andy Carroll is, you know, big, strong, sort of fulcrum of an attack, and the striker of that nature who is dominated in English football, if you like, for the last 10 years are the hallmark of that sort of striker would be Didier Drogba, and he was nowhere near the level that Andy Carroll is at now at the same age, so that has to augur well. On the other hand, I'm not sure why they were so desperate to get him this January as opposed to in the summer when perhaps they might have got him cheaper. I mean, I'm not what do they have to play for this season? Do they really think they can make it into the Champions League? Perhaps, I don't know.
No, they're 12 points off at the moment, so it does seem unlikely, but then so does £35 million for Andy Carroll.
Well, if you have the money to spend, why not spend it? A player is worth what a club is willing to pay for him, and while it might seem a lot, if he turns out to be a disastrous signing, which personally I don't think he will, I think he's a good player, far from the finished article, but I think he will be excellent. You know, would it be any worse than if they paid £5 million for six players who flopped, which, you know, Liverpool have been prone to do in recent years. And let's face it, a few months ago, Liverpool looked very much like they might go into administration and get relegated. So it's an exciting time for them. I think Carroll's better there than at Newcastle because he's going to learn at the knee of one of the greatest forwards I've ever seen play, Kenny Dalglish. I think he'll come on in leaps and bounds more so than he would have under Pardew. And I wouldn't worry too much about his proclivity for getting in scrapes. He's only a young fella, it happens to the best of us. And, you know, the occasional drunken nightclub fall or antic, it's not the end of the world.
At least he's got a captain there to put an arm around his shoulder. And
well, exactly, yes.
Tom Lutz, Adam Gray tweets in saying, who will score the most goals for their new clubs this season, Torres or Suarez?
Well, I think it depends how Torres is going to fit in at Chelsea, really. which has been a subject of much debate, and what formation they're going to play as well. But Suarez is one goal ahead already. But
was it his, though?
Well, I was going to say that. That's debatable whether he, right. whether he actually this, scored it.
So, OK, so the new-look Liverpool, or kind of interim, Liverpool 1.5, I think we might call it, took the field against Stoke yesterday with an exciting formation involving about nine defenders, as far as I can tell.
It's interesting that you talk about excitement, and Carroll is overpriced, but those two transfers, what they've done is enabled Liverpool to continue this momentum since the new owners have come in, and the last owners, as we know, weren't too popular, and they were kind of this moribund group of guys who just sat there, seen as leeching off the club. But you know, Dalglish is in now, they're now spending money. And I think Liverpool fans are excited. They might be doubtful, but it's a gamble is better than just sitting there doing nothing. Which
well, that's true.
Someone wrote into the Football 365 mailbox yesterday and they pointed out that in 2002, a striker who had scored 24 goals to help his side win promotion back to the Premier League, age 22, had bagged 15 goals by the end of January in his first season in the Premier League, scoring a goal against the reigning champs away to Arsenal and at home over Liverpool, and went on to make an England appearance in a friendly, get a call-up. Do you know who it was?
I've absolutely no idea. Paul? Tom?
James B? Kevin Phillips?
Michael Ricketts. So, could go either way for Andy Carroll, you know. I'm kind of curious to see. I think when he starts playing for Liverpool, I think he's going to be out for a while. He's still injured, isn't he? But how much of his good form this season has been down to Joey Barton? I think that has had a lot to do with it. Barton's been provider for a lot of his goals. I don't know who's going to do that at Liverpool, because Steven Gerrard's attempts to cross balls into him are more than likely going to end up in the Mersey.
Oh, fair. I think that's unfair.
Yeah.
Anfield's a long way from the Mersey. No, I think actually Gerrard's crossing is better than you give him credit for. He does lose.
I don't think it's as good as Joey Barton's.
That's very possible.
I think Andy Carroll makes crosses look very good because he's so mobile and agile in the air. I mean, it's not that difficult to spin balls up to him and let him make something good from them.
Interesting. Did England manage that time?
No, well, he was England's England, best player against France, wasn't he?
That's not saying much in that game.
Well, anyway, so Liverpool got a win against Stoke. Good goal from Morelis. And then, as you say, Suarez came on. Suarez hadn't trained with his teammates at that point, but looked very comfortable in a new team, in a new country, and scored, albeit with a little bit of help from a deflection. Well, no, the ball was going in, to be fair. It was just Wilkinson couldn't keep it out. And generally looked very impressive, Suarez, I thought. And next up for Liverpool then, Chelsea and the reunion with Torres. Chelsea, who without Fernando on Tuesday, were perhaps even more impressive in their massive 4-2 win away to Sunderland.
And also Nick Anelka in that game was arguably man of the match, and everyone seems to think it's him that's going to be edged aside to make room for Torres.
The kind of tactical reaction to this game was that Ancelotti had moved Anelka back into the midfield in order to make room for potentially Torres up front, and that might be a kind of blueprint for how they would take on Liverpool in future matches. I personally don't know if Ancelotti would go with effectively three forwards on the pitch at the same time, but he certainly had a brilliant game on Tuesday, Anelka.
The keeper saying this morning that Anelka isn't going to be at Chelsea for very much longer, and that in the summer they say he's going to go to New York Red Bulls, where he'll form a deadly strike force with Thierry Henry.
How reliable is L'Equipe?
Generally, they're pretty good on French matters.
All right. Well, there you go, because Drogba, a lot of people are saying
they haven't said it's, they haven't guaranteed it.
No, well, that's nice.
They said this is the suggestion, and they pointed out that his brother, Claude Anelka, is a coach in the American League as well. So he has long-standing interest in the US.
All right then, okay. Chelsea though? Chelsea against Liverpool? Any thoughts on that?
I think some of the alleged anger that's going to be directed at Torres is maybe been exaggerated by those pictures of shirts being burnt. And I wouldn't be surprised if some photographer had gone over to some 14-year-old kids in Liverpool and said, I'll give you a fiver if you burn this shirt. I'm not sure. I mean, there'll be hostility, but I think that those kind of photos have exaggerated.
There was the heartbreaking tale of the six-year-old who just spent his Christmas money on the letters T-O-R-R. An ES for the back of his replica shirt. And nobody wants to see that kind of thing.
There was an awful lot of guff spoken, though, just before he made his move, by Liverpool fans saying that it could never happen because he's developed such an emotional attachment to the club and he's almost a naturalised Scouser and all that. Whereas, in fact, if he could leave Atletico Madrid, which genuinely was the club of his heart, then he could obviously leave Liverpool. And he made no bones about it in his interview as soon as he arrived at Chelsea, yeah, where he just talked like a cold professional saying, "I'm moving up a level."
The game.
Those fans are delusional. Like as recently as Monday morning, they were rubbishing and poo-pooing the very notion that Torres would leave. We've been saying in here since the summer that he'd leave it in the January window and
you
go
predicted
to Chelsea.
It, didn't you, Barry?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, there you
and
go.
Guillem Balague, the Spanish journalist, said it was going to happen on Friday, and he was
and yet
subjected
it did go
to
ahead. Extraordinary.
He was subjected to unbelievable abuse, but fans are fickle like that. I'd wet myself laughing if he scored a hat-trick and ran off to the Liverpool end kissing his Chelsea.
I think there's every chance that he will score, assuming he plays, because that is one sector of Liverpool's team that that remains weak, in my opinion, defensively, despite the plethora of defenders that they deploy.
Jamie Carragher is better now.
Yeah, that doesn't really strengthen him, in my opinion, anymore.
All right, then.
He's been a great player and all that.
But. Well, Liverpool won, famously, against Chelsea, the reverse fixture, but that was really thanks to Torres, who's now, I was going to say, playing for the other side, but
Drogba,
you know what I mean.
Lampard and Essien weren't available then. Drogba did come on later, I think, and changed the momentum in the game, but he was nowhere near full fitness.
Not looking good then for Liverpool. That's the pod's feeling on that one. Quick mention for Newcastle, who are now without, of course, Andy Carroll, having stuck him in a helicopter at the first available opportunity and sent him post-haste to Liverpool in return for large bag of cash. And they then got beaten by Fulham this midweek and lost Shola Amiobi into the bargain.
Just on the subject, you suggested there that Newcastle ushered him out the door, which is pretty much what Carroll has been suggesting. We must also point out that Carroll, though he said that he has undying loyalty to Newcastle and everything, apparently he went into Alan Pardew's office on that day just to negotiate a new contract, having no notion whatsoever of moving club. He'd only got a new contract in November. So is he so loyal to them that he needs to go in every week and negotiate a new contract? I don't know.
Just needs reassurance.
Seems fair to me. Very good. Well, still to come, West Ham and the big battle at the bottom, and lots of love for Man United. But up next, we're on to the continent. Joining us now on Football Weekly Extra is Paolo Bandini. Been a big midweek round, but aren't they always in Serie A? Milan got held by Lazio, an opportunity for their rivals, an opportunity they mostly blew, although Inter have yet to play against a Bari team whose president has just had a bomb put under his house. But I really wanted to riff on Juve's pain.
Yeah, I mean, as the week as a whole goes, it's one of those weeks that you're going to really not be able to properly evaluate until Inter have played, because they're the ones who really stand to benefit from the whole thing. But certainly, if you're looking at teams who've lost out this week, it's Juventus again, and it's a very difficult point for them. They haven't won away from home, I think, now since I think it's early December against away to Catania. So it's been, it's been some time since they've actually won away from home at all. They weren't actually thoroughly outplayed. They went behind very early against Palermo, and then, there was actually some encouraging signs from them for a little while, but they really did lack penetration once again at the top of the pitch. They finally brought in a new striker, Matri, who had a pretty disappointing
debut.
How
much did they pay for him?
They haven't paid it yet, but they're going to pay in total. It'll be 18 million euros.
18 million euros?
Yeah, it's one of these. Every deal in Italy this season, it's the new trend this year, is to loan a player for a fee and then basically make an agreement that you have to sign him at the end of the loan for a bigger fee, which seems to be a typically clever piece of accounting to, I guess, deal with A, the need to not spend all that money up front, but also I'm sure it has implications for the tax man and for financial fair play and all those things.
Right. Okay, he didn't have the best of starts though, Matri. When you compare it to, say, Pazzini's debut at Inter, the player that they really wanted but couldn't afford.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest with you, he's been brought in to replace Amaury, and Amaury has scored, you know, less goals since January 2009 than Giorgio Chiellini, and they've played a comparable number of games, so a centre-back's outscored him. So, you know, he can't be a lot worse, actually. But, you know, he got himself in some good positions. He had a couple of really good chances, and he didn't take either of them. And when you're a striker and you've been brought in to replace a striker who wasn't scoring goals, if you get two good chances and don't take them, then you haven't had a great debut. But I think he's going to be an improvement for them. I think he's going to be okay.
All right, Juve are now eight. Now, they're only 4 points off the Champions League positions, but they've got a trip to Cagliari next. Ooh, what a goal by Raja Nainggolan against Sampdoria at the weekend. It was at Sampdoria, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I thought it was a great goal at first, and I realised it was a deflection, and I felt it took a little bit.
Yeah, but the build-up before that, it was like that famous Ronaldinho goal for Barcelona, where he cuts inside and beats four players with four touches, and then, hey, press, other amazing. Anyway, then after the trip to Cagliari, not an easy place to go, Juve are up against Inter, and you can see them dropping out of the top 10, can't you, Paolo?
Top 10, maybe not, but they're certainly eight. Yeah, but I'd say I need to have a look at the league table. I'm not sure how close the teams behind them are.
Well, 7 points off 11th place. So
yeah, I think it's one of those leagues at the moment where it's sort of there is a big divide down the middle of it. Cagliari could probably catch them, but I think after that, everyone's a bit further behind.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, the issue for Juventus is what's the long-term picture here now? And, you know, you and I were talking about this just before we came into the podcast. I mean, we're now, you know, a good few years post Calciopoli, and it seems like things are going to get, you know, possibly tougher even before they get better. I think there was a massive underestimation on the behalf of a lot of people of how long it would take to get this team back where it was. I think you look at the first year they were back in Serie A, the top two scorers, not just for Juve, for the whole of Serie A, were Del Piero and David Trezeguet. Now Trezeguet's gone, Del Piero's, he's not completely past it, but he can't play. He's not going to give you 40 good games a season anymore. He might give you, you know, 25. And Nedved's gone, and Camoranesi's gone. Buffon's only just back from a long injury. But essentially, you know, the core of that team is gone, and they're trying to build a whole new one. They haven't got the money that they used to have, although they spent a phenomenal amount, actually. They've got a net spend of 120-odd million since...
they've been the second-highest spenders in the last 2 years. Outspent by Milan this time and Inter last time around.
The second-highest spenders, but the biggest net spenders. They've had the biggest gap between what they've brought in and what they've sold, because obviously, you know, both Milan and Inter have actually managed to recoup some of the money they've been spending. So, yeah, I mean, they've spent a lot of money. And the issue is, you know, it can't just be, you know, it can't be fixed as it was.
Well, we always thought that Calciopoli was a bit of a blip and they would soon be bouncing back. But I'm now of the opinion that we'll soon be looking back on Juve's period of dominance in much the same way we do with Genoa back in the days of baggy trousers, and also Bologna in the 60s. I think.
See, I think you might be a little bit more pessimistic than me, but I can see where
they just don't have the money, and they're not going to get it either. They were the most supported club, but kids these days, I don't think, are going to grow up supporting Juve because of Calciopoli, because they don't win anything. They're not in Europe, and they're not at this rate going to be again this year, or at least in the big Europe. They're still paying for this stadium, which apparently is going to sort everything out. But as we were pointing out before, they're currently playing in a stadium right in the centre of town. Couldn't be more convenient. It only takes 27,000 people, and they can't even fill that. So how they're suddenly going to draw these big crowds out to the area of, what's it called, Grugliasco, I think, where the Delle Alpi is situated, which nobody ever liked in the old days, I don't know. But hey, Juve fans, sorry about that. Move to Palermo. That's my tip. Barry Glendening.
No one's listening to you. You're like a pair of trees falling in the forest when no one's there.
Very happy trees, though. You know, very happy
trees. It just occurred to me there while my mind was meandering during
that. You left
that.
The gas on.
No, that I think your annual ski trip this year might clash with Paolo's forthcoming very exciting nuptials.
Yeah.
Which means we won't have anyone to talk about Syria. I'll have to do the Syria roundup. Me and Lotzi.
Look forward to that.
We'll just read the results. That'll be it.
Good. Paolo.
Right.
I wouldn't say it's underappreciated, but apparently that's all the time we've got today. Anything else you wanted to add?
He's off to Dallas to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's true. You are, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Proper football.
Yeah, yeah. No, it should be a lot of fun. I'm trying to think what else would be particularly saying. No, as I say, I think...
Sorry, Paolo, wasn't there a refereeing controversy in the Juve game?
There was,
yeah. Juventus should have had a penalty. Now, as the Palermo manager pointed out afterwards, of course, this penalty, if they'd given it, then Juventus wouldn't have got the ensuing corner from which they scored their goal anyway. So it's a bit of a swings around a situation, but it should have been a penalty, and Juventus were furious about it. It was quite convenient, actually, because you touched on this, I know, in the podcast on Monday, James, that wonderful Tutto Sport headline, everyone to blame. Whereas today, it's not everyone to blame, it's just the referee to blame. Mm. Nothing to do with the fact that we weren't good enough to beat Palermo.
Yeah. Get used to it. That's what I say. Paolo, thank you ever so much. Best of luck in Dallas and with forthcoming nuptials. Thanks for joining us. A couple of posts for you here. Cheezoid says, Chambéry for Le Coupe. Fifth tier Chambéry. Knockout three Ligue 1 sides, Monaco, Brest and Sochaux, in succession in the Coupe de France. Blimey. Is there a story here? Is it another Crawley town on our hands? Chambéry, Paul. It's a lovely word, that, isn't it? Chambéry. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, okay. Are they a Crawley town?
Well, not quite. They're not as financially flush as Crawley town are. It's a genuinely romantic story of just a group of amateurs who are all best mates, beating three, as you said, three top flight teams. And although five teams in the fifth tier have made it to the last eight of the Cup in history.
Oh, in history, right, yeah.
These are the only ones who have ever beaten so many top flight teams on the way. As you said, they've beaten three.
So they're in the quarterfinals.
They are, yeah. And in the previous round, they knocked out Monaco.
Yeah.
And of course, a lot of people often ask why so many lower league teams make it to the latter stages.
We're always talking
French
about
that. Yeah. There was a Guy Lacombe, the Monaco manager, came up with a theory, a rather bitter theory, after Chambéry beat them in the last round. He said it was populism on behalf of the authorities, who were basically contriving to ensure that things got this way. But nobody took that seriously. It was considered the desperate talk of a man who knew the result would cost him his job. And sure enough, he was sacked a few days later.
Mm. Mm. All right, well, anyway, we'll be keeping an eye out for Chambéry in the Coupe de France. Lovely. Alex Wilson says, why is the South Wales derby so wonderful, bigger than every other game before it, and so on? Not sure. I'm not sure if the local police... Oh, Sid Lowe interrupts us at that crucial juncture. We were just going to discuss the South Wales derby, which might just edge out the fact that Real Madrid and Barcelona both got to the Copa del Rey final. In terms of importance, were it not for the fact that Adebayor scored, is that right?
Yes, it is right. Yeah, it was the 94th minute. Madrid were on course for another 1-0 win. I was looking at the figures last night. I'll see if I can get this right now. And I noticed that it looked like binary code for Real Madrid's recent results, because you look at it, and last night there was 94th minute. They were 1-0 up against Sevilla, which would have meant their last results would have been 1-1, 1-0, 1-0, 1-0, 0-1, 1-0. And then Adebayor had to go and bloody ruin it by scoring a goal in the 94th minute to make it 2-0 last night.
Mm. What kind of celebration did he do?
He sort of ran towards the crowd, then ran into the corner, and it looked like he tried to skid on his knees into the corner, which will be familiar. But I don't know if the pitch was a bit too dry, because he didn't really skid. He more sort of tumbled forward and rolled over, and lots of people kind of jumped on him, and a few people ruffled his hair.
Okay, that's lovely. What else is in the news in Spain, is it?
Well, that's the focus of everything now, is Madrid-Barcelona in the Copa del Rey final. As you can imagine, there's also the fallout from the winter transfer window, which actually was almost irrelevant in Spain. Virtually nothing happened. And then, of course, the continuing pressure at Real Madrid because of the fact that they were beaten by Osasuna at the weekend, and because of the fact that the battle between Mourinho and Valdano continues to be kind of rumbling away in the background, despite the fact that Mourinho got what he wanted, which was the striker who you mentioned a minute ago.
Sid, you say that nothing happened in the transfer window in Spain, but it nearly did, because Tottenham bid for just about every striker in the Primera Liga. How has that been reported over there? Are they considered to have been serious bids?
No, I think that the Spanish largely see it, to be honest, the way that I see it, that Daniel Levy put on the tape of the Benny Hill theme tune and then went over to Spain and chased around every single striker he could possibly find in the whole country, mostly with really big bids that had no chance of success. And there was a bid turned down for Fernando Llorente, there was a big bid turned down for Giuseppe Rossi. My understanding of it is that there wasn't a bid for Diego Forlan, but the reason there wasn't a concrete bid for Diego Forlan was because they realised that they couldn't actually do a deal with Forlan in terms of his personal terms, so there was no point in making a bid. Atletico Madrid were waiting for it and it never quite happened, although they knew that what kind of level Spurs would come in at if it was going to happen. So yeah, Spurs went absolutely bonkers and got no one, and I think most people in Spain basically consider it not to have been particularly serious in the first place.
Sid, what did the Spanish make of the Premier League's transfer window, in which £225 million overspent compared to 30 million last year, massively outstripping all the other European leagues. Was there a bit of kind of concern at the newfound swagger in certain oligarchs' approach to the transfer market, or was it seen as kind of symptom of a football gone mad?
No, I think the focus, the same actually as in England, the main focus was Fernando Torres, and I think more than anything, there's almost been a degree of pride here that you know, Torres could command that kind of transfer fee in England, 58 million euros from their point of view, of course, which makes him the most expensive Spaniard ever, above Gaizka Mendieta, who I think I'm right in saying it was something like 48 million euros that he went to Lazio for, God knows how long ago now, 2001 maybe.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's genuinely a sense of pride in Torres having you know, made enough of a name for himself in England to be able to go for that kind of fee. Of course, there's a certain degree of concern that look how much money English clubs can spend, and frankly, Spanish clubs can't even, apart from the big two, just cannot even begin to get close to those kind of figures. So there's perhaps a little bit of concern there. But as I say, the focus has all been on Torres, and I know, you know, the Spanish. You'd expect the Spanish to have their own, you know, their own club's purchases to be concerned about. And of course, Adebayor and the number nine issue at Real Madrid has absolutely dominated the media. But over the last 3 or 4 days, Fernando Torres has been front page everywhere in Spain. That has been the biggest transfer story without any doubt, even though it's two English clubs.
Sid, do Sky Sports in Spain have a similar thing on transfer deadline day with a load of reporters loitering like dirty old men outside training grounds, shouting things at millionaires in nice cars?
Not quite, but there was an element of that, because there isn't really an equivalent of Sky Sports News in Spain. What there is now is Gol Televisión, and what they had was their Madrid-based reporter, Carolina, standing outside the offices of the Spanish football league, basically saying, and this is where the bids will come in, and the fax machine will be going bonkers, and she might as well have stood there with puppy going past her, and the poor girl was desperately trying to make this exciting. And there were only 6 deals done on the final day of the Spanish transfer window, most of them more or less relevant, although surprisingly Deportivo involved in buying 3 players and attacking players too, which is a real shock. But no, there wasn't that sense of drama and excitement, and actually, because I think generally speaking the Spanish probably have more awareness of international football than your average football fan in England does, the focus on the final day was very, very much turned on England rather than on Spain.
All right then. Why was this such a shock, Deportivo buying 3 attacking players?
Because Deportivo have absolutely no attacking intent whatsoever, are probably the dullest team in the whole wide world ever, with a very, very dull coach and absolutely no money. So for them to bring in 3 players and 3 attacking players is really going some.
All right, excellent. Good news there for fans in Galicia. Now then, that's it for Sid Lowe's Spanish Roundup. Sorry, it's all Skid Row.
Skid Row Spanish Roundup.
Ah, dear me. Lovely. That's it then for part 2. Sid, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Look forward to speaking to you on Monday.
Cheers.
Sid Lowe in Spain. Anyway, now that's it for part 2. And next up... big results from midweek and some big clashes coming up at the weekend in the Premier League.
Football Weekly Extra on guardian.co.uk.
All sorts of big movements at the bottom of the Premier League midweek, with particularly West Ham travelling to Bloomfield Road and getting a 3-1 victory. Wow, they launch off the bottom of the table, up to third last now. And Tom Lutz.
I think it shows how ridiculous all the talk about Avram Grant getting sacked was a month or so ago. They weren't in that much trouble then. I mean, they were bottom of the league, but not they weren't a Portsmouth. They weren't like 10, you know, 6 or 7 points off safety. And now, like, a decent win and, you know, they're 1 point off safety.
Not even that. They're only goal difference off safety. And, curiously enough, the team that is just ahead of them is Birmingham, and we'll be talking more about that, who they're facing this weekend, that's the curious bit, and we'll be talking more about them in a second. But I just wanted to touch a little bit on the performance, because it had 2 brilliant goals from Victor Obinna, who's now, I think, scored 5 goals in his last 2 games. My word, he's turned out to be a real lifesaver for them. And Robbie Keane scoring on his debut
for his boyhood club.
Exactly, yeah. He dreamt of that when he was a kid.
Yeah, well, other quite a few new signings, high-profile signings, scored on their debuts, which, you know...
Suarez.
And
Daniel Sturridge. Yeah. Any others?
But, you know, that's their job, to score goals.
Yeah.
So...
All right, then.
well, it's good for West Ham fans. I disagree with Tom in that I think all the talk about Grant getting fired some time ago was completely justified, because West Ham were an abject shambles. Now, they strung a couple of results together, but they're by no means safe by any stretch of the imagination yet. I thought that game was quite interesting, just how would Charlie Adams' mindset be affected in light of, apparently he's furious that he wasn't sold to Liverpool. They came with a late £14 million bid for him, which would have been a bet, because it's difficult to know yet whether he's just another Steve Sidwell or if he is going to last the pace and be a top player. Andy Reid was in for Blackpool as well, so you'd like two overweight Celts with magic wands for a left peg in the side, and apparently Reid played quite well. I think he'd be a good signing for them. And West Ham, it's far too early to be saying West Ham are safe.
All right, then. No, they're not safe, but
they're not safe.
Big step, especially when they've got... Sorry, Paul.
No, I was just going to say the one thing that's absolutely certain about this weekend is that Birmingham will play Nikola Zigic, because he tormented West Ham in the recent Carling Cup matches, and they simply couldn't deal with him. So as much as they seem to have found their scoring form recently, it'll be interesting to see whether they can start defending better.
So then, Tom, the other day you were in here walking on air after Birmingham's come-from-behind win over West Ham in the Carling Cup semi-finals. How positive are you about their chances this weekend after snatching that 2-2 draw with Man City Wednesday night?
Well, they seem to have got a lot more positive since that result in the FA Cup match. They came back from two goals down and won 3-2. Then they were down against Man City last night and came back. And obviously in the semi-final they came back as well. So they start to show some spirit, which they always had. But now that adding to that, they've actually started to score goals, which is what was missing before. And it's interesting what Paul was saying about Zigic with West Ham. I think he will be a factor, although oddly, I didn't really think he did anything against West Ham. He distracted players, but actually when he got the ball, he pretty much messed things up. So it's almost just his presence unsettles people rather than actually what he does.
He's got a surprisingly bad touch for a big man, as the saying goes.
But he created chaos every time.
Yeah.
Bentley, proven to be a good signing, or just that he's the flashy one who catches your eye on the highlights?
I think he's a bit like Zigic, and again, he just, obviously not in that he's 6'9" tall. But
he's got amazing technique, Bentley.
But in that his presence unsettles people, he gives something else for opponents to think about. And he can score those spectacular goals as well. He scored one the other week.
Well, he effectively scored the one last night as well.
Yeah.
Interesting. Of course, the results seen in a rather different perspective by Man City, that 2-2 draw at St Andrews, who have now in their last three games got what? A defeat at Villa, then the 1-1 draw with League One's Notts County, and then this. Now, what was the reaction from Roberto Mancini? Somebody mentioned that he said, oh, we got what we came for, which seems a bit unambitious for a team chasing the title.
I don't think that's what he said. I know he was very unhappy with that because he thought Kevin Phillips dived to win a penalty.
Do you think he dived for the penalty?
No.
Right.
And even if he had, I mean, that's what players do these days, isn't it? It's a sad fact of life, and there's certainly plenty of players in the Manchester City side who'd have a dive in their locker too if it came to it. So to complain about it is a bit disingenuous. To be honest, a team like Manchester City should have no problem beating Birmingham. And if they struggled, if they could only draw with them, it's entirely their own fault, I think. I'll probably get hammered for saying it, but there you go.
Mm. Man City are going to be home to West Brom at the weekend. Man United, meanwhile, take on the team who are rock bottom of the table, Wolves. Man United, who are looking better and better there at the top of the table. A 3-1 victory over Villa on Tuesday with Rooney getting a brace. We've always been big fans. I don't think we ever really lost confidence that Rooney was a top-level striker here in the pod, so take a moment to pat ourselves on the back. Fantastic stuff there.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, then. No, but I mean, it is, you know, if you're the competition, you see Man United creaking along but grinding out the results, and then suddenly they start really playing to their potential.
But they do still have all the big games to come. Chelsea twice, City, Arsenal, Liverpool.
Yep.
And they've no Gary Neville.
And they've no Gary Neville, as Richard Williams is putting it. Another member of United's matchless crop walks away into history. Only Giggs and Scholes left now. Yes, there you are. Gary Neville.
He's a red. He hates Scousers. Is that a red because he's a Mancunian red or a communist?
I think there's also a reference to his kind of supposed unionist activity or unionist, not in the kind
Berry of... Berry-wearing fullback.
Yeah.
There's talk he's going to go to Sky. I, for one, would welcome that.
Cause or EastEnders. That was your suggestion, Paul Doyle.
I would also that he's already in there as Doc Cotton, isn't he?
All right, okay.
But he has plenty of forthright opinions, which is something quite a few pundits don't have.
Right.
Whether you agree with them or not, they're usually worth listening to. And there's also talk that apparently a couple of Liverpool forums, and I don't know if this is true, I just heard it from some, are already trying to line up a boycott of Sky if Gary Neville goes to join. He's absolutely despised by many, many fans, particularly Liverpool fans, because he makes no secret of his own contempt for anyone from Liverpool.
It's been a while since Liverpool fans boycotted anything, so it's due one, I think, as well.
Mm. I can see him more going into coaching, no? Do you not think?
Well, he doesn't seem to want to, though. I think he seems to want to go down the punditry route, and there's an opening now as well. So.
Why, Gary, why? Okay.
Have you ever...
met Gary Neville? I haven't, actually.
No, you've never been in the studio with him or anything?
No. I rarely enter the rarefied world of live broadcasts and that. However, who knows, eh? But rather than his future, a quick word on his past, perhaps?
Oh, he's a marvellous servant for Manchester United. Only played for one club, only had one manager as a senior player, which I would imagine is probably a first, unless you're talking about a player who's...
For 20 years of career, yeah, that's
career
pretty
extraordinary. Was curtailed by injury maybe or something, but I thought he was an excellent player. He's struggled badly in the last couple of seasons, and, you know, that's just age catching up with him. And I have nothing but the highest regard for him. And there was that famous celebration in front of Liverpool fans, which was quite amusing, you know. And these things, they just liven up the game, make it more interesting. You need your pantomime villains, and he was one of them.
Yeah, there's talk. Some people have been suggesting that he's been the best fullback of his generation.
Arsene Wenger said that.
Did he?
Yeah, he said the best British fullback.
Because I don't think it's funny in terms of longevity and medal haul. Obviously, nothing but praise there. But almost at no point in his long career has he even been the best fullback at Man United. Dennis Irwin was a far better player than him. Patrice Evra now is a better player than him. But, as I say, in terms of longevity and medals, he's done well to stick around for
never,
as long as he
never
has.
Mind the quality, feel the wit. That's the thing. And a valuable aid to Sir Alex Ferguson in the dressing room, of course. He'll be missed
he's
probably
suggesting he's a teacher's pet. Didn't Yap Stam have quite a damning summation of the Nevilles in his autobiography, where he used the C word to call them a busy bear pair of...
Really?
Oh, I thought he was doing that in a complimentary way.
I don't know if it was complimentary or just that he thought they were a busy pair of...
Be an interesting scrap, that, wouldn't it? Yap Stam against...
both Nevilles.
Gary Neville. Or both Nevilles, even tag-teaming on...
Well, I think Yap Stam would hammer either Neville, but two of them again. Maybe both Nevilles and Shane McGowan against Yap Stam.
All right, well, Gary Neville, who announced his retirement, having effectively, I think, retired in that West Brom game back in New Year's Day. But anyway, marvellous stuff. Barry didn't mention Newcastle. We did mention Newcastle. We didn't mention that they're playing Arsenal this weekend. And as I say, Carroll's gone. He wasn't going to play anyway. Amiobi's now out injured. It could get ugly, that one. Arsenal looking quite robust midweek in their game against Everton. But you wanted to talk about...
Well, no, it's just there was an interesting thing that happened in a... League One match between Charlton and Colchester on Tuesday night. Now, I haven't seen it, unfortunately, but I just read about it on our Football League blog, where Charlton won the game 1-0, but Colchester had a goal that was allowed, then disallowed, then after consultation between the linesman and ref, allowed again, and then finally disallowed, which I think makes Colchester the first team in football history to lose 1-0 despite scoring two goals.
It's remarkable.
Yeah.
How long did all of that take?
Apparently it took several minutes. It was an offside decision. I think the ref disallowed it for offside.
Right.
Then the linesman brought him over and said, no, it wasn't offside, you need to give it. So then he gave it. And then I think the Charlton manager, Chris Powell, argued so much with the fourth official that the ref had to go over and get involved again, and then allowed it again, and then finally disallowed it.
Disallowed it.
I have yet to hear a definitive account of what actually happened.
Let us know, Charlton Colchester fans, if you were there. Magnificent. That's it then for today. We'll be back on Monday as ever to round up all the weekend's action. In the meantime, many thanks to guest producer Pascal, to Paul Doyle, Barry Glendinning and Tom Lutz. And you, the listener, if you fancy a quick European paper review, there'll be one up on Friday morning. But in the meantime, until we next speak, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.